Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Greetings and good evening. This is Tabitha, and you are listening to White Wellness. Hope everybody is doing well and has had a good week so far. Just wanted to make an announcement that I'm now accepting donations if anyone is inclined to do so, and thank you to the person who did donate. Very much appreciated. And also, I wrote two articles this week. I wrote one that came out a couple of days ago. It came out June 17th, so that was Monday. And it was an article about tofu and about how tofu isn't this terrible, scary thing that we've been told that it is. And then I wrote another article that just came out today, which is about LGBTP activists that are pushing parents to bring children to pride parades. So if you haven't checked those out, please do. So to start off, I wanted to actually read this tofu article because it didn't get too much traction. I did get the first person who, I guess, left a comment was a comment that didn't get approved, and the person just wrote, "Soy makes you queer!" exclamation point. I'm assuming the person did not read the article, but it's very good information in regards to what type of soy is healthy and then what type of soy isn't healthy. So I'm going to start by reading this recipe, or reading this article rather, and if you like what you hear, you can go check out the recipe, which is listed below the text. So the article is called Optimal Recipe Corner, Sesame Baked Tofu. So here it is. There has been much debate on the Tribune and in general regarding the consumption of soy products. The philo-Semitic homophiles on the right would like us to believe that eating tofu will turn men into weaklings with breasts. This is rather rich, coming from a bunch of misogynists who see nothing wrong with having a tranny for a spouse as long as that person is, quote, trad. It's proof of the inverted times we live in that there is legitimate fear of soy, gluten, and carbohydrates, but the permanent hormonal mutilation of humans, read genocide, is lauded. So now their article goes in to mention Okinawa, which I've mentioned before on another broadcast where I talked about the blue zones, and this is an area in Japan where they're known for extreme longevity. It's actually the bluest of the blue zones. They have the most longevity in this area, and they actually eat quite a bit of tofu. So here's a bit about Okinawa. The people of Okinawa, the southernmost island of Japan, are known for having the greatest longevity on the planet. When their diet was studied, it was found that Okinawan people consumed twice as much tofu as other Japanese. Their cuisine also includes large quantities of sea vegetables, bitter melon, also known as goya, sweet potatoes, especially the Satsuma Imo, turmeric, mugwort, brown rice, garlic, onions, peppers, tomatoes, leafy greens, daikon radish, carrots, shiitake mushrooms, jasmine green tea, miso soup, fermented cabbage, sake, fish, and small amounts of pork, which is usually only reserved for a ceremonial occasion. Whole soy foods are eaten today and in the past in Okinawa. People used to carry tofu in woks on their heads. Soy consumption in Okinawa is more than any population in the world. The average Okinawan eats about 3 ounces of tofu daily, and this tofu has a greater concentration of protein and fat than its Japanese or Chinese counterparts. This tofu is used in stir-fries and soups. Miso, a fermented soy product, is used as a flavoring commonly throughout Okinawa. Edamame, A type of fresh soybean is also part of the diet. Other fermented soy products include tamari soy sauce, shoyu soy sauce, and natto. Tempeh, a fermented soybean cake, is native to Indonesia. The Okinawans have a very low rate of prostate and breast cancer. They also have healthy thyroids, low rates of dementia, and have very large families. They do not have the ill health effects from consuming soy products, which has been popularized in the Western media, triple parentheses right there. Positive health claims for cardiovascular disease, such as lowering cholesterol and triglycerides, have been made. Older Okinawan women who consume more soy products have less menopausal symptoms and hot flashes. Soy isoflavones have shown improvement in bone density. When compared to Americans of the same age, the male and female centenarians of Okinawa had higher levels of sex hormones. So that kind of takes anything that people are saying about soy making you into a queer or any of these other untrue statements when it's proven that the people who consume the most amount of soy have the highest levels of sex hormones. Now, the article goes on to show a video where they these two men talk about the Okinawan diet, and here's a bit about unhealthy soy. Consumption of any processed or denatured soy product, such as textured vegetable protein, TSP, also known as TSP, textured soy protein isolate, which I'm seeing in tons of tranny meat, soy oil, soy nuts, or any types of tranny meat, have deleterious effects on health and are best avoided. Many soy milks are also heavily processed and contain a host of unsavory ingredients. Eden Soy is one of the only brands that is produced using traditional methods, and that's a really good soy milk if anyone is looking to try a soy milk or is looking to perhaps try a healthier one. If Eden Soy is available in your area, I would suggest trying that one. And my favorite flavor happens to be the carob. So here's a little bit about the history of tofu. Tofu was brought to Japan along with Buddhism from China by way of the Korean Peninsula around 12th century. Tofu was first prepared and used in cooking by monks at Buddhist temples. By the 17th century, tofu had finally reached the commoners' kitchens, and it became a very popular ingredient in vegetarian dishes. This popularity led to the publication of two tofu cookbooks in the middle to 18th century. Together, these two cookbooks contain 238 recipes. Some of these preparations still remain popular today. And then the article goes on to a recipe for sesame-baked tofu. And this is a really nice recipe. Anyone who's interested in maybe trying tofu for the first time or maybe having it in a different way, cooking it in maybe a healthier way. Because oftentimes if you go to a, you know, Chinese or Japanese restaurant, number one, you can't be sure of the quality. Is it non-GMO? Is it organic? Most of the time, at bare minimum, it is going to be non-GMO, but you can't guarantee that it's going to be organic. And also, they tend to cook it in ways that's not so healthy. So it's best to make stuff at home, always. And I would suggest trying this recipe if you're, you know, in the market for trying something new. And I just wanted to go over quickly what tamari, shoyu, those are types of soy sauces, and tempeh were, in case people weren't aware of what those are, just to give a little definition of what those are. Okay, here we go. Okay, so soy sauce is a generic term for dark, salty seasoning made from soybeans, water, and salt. There are three basic types of soy sauce listed below that are distinctly different from each other. Shoyu and tamari can be used interchangeably, but each has its own character. So what is shoyu soy sauce? Shoyu is a naturally brewed soy sauce made from soybeans, wheat, water, and sea salt. It is processed in the traditional Japanese way and aged for 2 to 3 years. No coloring or preservatives are used. Smooth, rich, and dark, shoyu is delicious in vegetarian cooking. So that is not a wet, that's a wheat soy sauce. It's a little smoother than the tamari. I tend to prefer it, but I keep them both on hand because they work in different ways. This recipe actually uses both of them. And the second type is tamari. Another natural soy sauce, tamari is primarily made from soybeans with up to 10% wheat. It is also available wheat-free. Most of the time it is wheat-free, especially with all this this gluten-free stuff going on. And it has a slightly stronger flavor than shoyu. It's also a little saltier. And then commercial soy sauce is just like the crap that pretty much most restaurants use, like the Kikkoman, that type of stuff. It's similar in appearance to natural brewed soy sauce, but they are artificially colored and processed. They are not recommended for daily use. I've actually heard if you take a drop of the chemical soy sauce and you add it to a shot glass that has like a filled up with water and you put a drop of the chemical soy sauce, it'll disperse in a very different way than the natural ones do. Of course, you're going to pay a little bit more for the natural ones, but they're health supportive and the chemical ones are not. And then lastly, tempeh. Tempeh was developed in Indonesia, and tempeh is a sliceable cake of soybeans that have been split and cooked to remove the hull. A culture is added to the cooked soybeans, and they are allowed to age for 1 to 2 days. The culture covers the cake, holding it together. Tempeh has a distinct aroma and flavor. High in vitamin B12 and protein, tempeh can be sliced thin, braised, boiled, or baked. So if you haven't tried tempeh, it's fermented, so it doesn't get nearly as bad as a reputation as tofu does, because tofu is not fermented. This is something that maybe you want to try. And I was just reading that from a wonderful cookbook that I've had for quite some time. It's an older cookbook. It came out in 1985. And the cookbook is called The Natural Foods Cookbook by Mary Estella. And I will put a little link in the archive when this show is archived. So if others want to check this book out, you could probably buy it on Amazon for less than $10. So now I want to talk a little bit about black soybeans, which are a type of soybean. Most people are probably aware of just the typical white soybean, which is used to make tofu and things like that, but there is a black soybean, which is lauded for a lot of its health benefits in, I guess, mostly Asia, but you can buy them here. I actually just bought some today online because I really like them and they're really tasty and they have additional benefits than soy just has. So here's a little bit about black soybeans. They kind of look like a black bean, but not quite like a black turtle bean, like what you'd use to make like a black bean soup. They have more of a spherical or a round, shape to them. And they're usually cooked with like a little bit of soy sauce. So here's a bit about black soybeans. Black soybeans have been placed in the back burner for too long. People need to recognize that this legume, the main ingredient of soy sauce, is nutritional and healthy. Perhaps it is the steady impression we have that soy sauce is filled with too much sodium, which is consequentially bad for our health, that has caused us to shy away from this plant. Even so, taken as they are, black soybeans offer many of the same benefits as other soybeans. Now, of course, salt is necessary. We don't want to eat chemicalized salt. That's another good reason to eat inside the home as much as possible, because every restaurant, even fancy restaurants, are just using like crappy salt, and kosher salt is totally crappy. It's got tons of additives in it, so the best salts are always sea salts. So the medicinal nature of black soybeans is found in ancient traditional texts of Chinese and Russian healers. It is stated that the crop nourishes the yin, the female energy, prinsal, and balances qi, which is internal energy, and normalizes the activity of the stomach and the spleen. It's high in vitamin A, B, and E, good source of protein and fiber, amino acids, and anocyanin, which I think gives it its dark color. Medicinal uses of black beans. So the black beans are really good, like I said before, with the soybeans, good for menopause and hot flashes, also good for heart palpitations and muscle pain. Scientists have analyzed the components of black soybeans and concluded that their anocyanin, that's a flavonoid, if the content is even higher than that of blueberries. Also good for lowering cholesterol. The various amino acids may prevent the onset of cancer. And there are numerous ways to use them. I would say the best way is a recipe that I'm going to give in just a moment. But you can use them really in any way you'd use a bean. And the recipe that I was going to share is actually in this Natural Foods Cookbook. And it is called 5 Senses Black Soybean and Rice. So this recipe calls for mixing black soybeans with 2 types of brown rice, corn, and carrot. So I'll just go through this recipe briefly. You're going to want 1 cup of brown rice, 1 cup of short grain brown rice, 1/2 cup of sweet brown rice, also known as glutinous rice, 1/2 cup of black soybeans, 1 to 2 ears of corn taken off the cob or shucked, 1 carrot diced, 4 cups of water, and a pinch of salt. So here is the procedure. So first, I guess you want to soak the soybeans overnight, and then you want to wash and soak both of the rices, wash the black beans and drain, and then you want to dry roast the beans in a heavy skillet until they pop, stirring to prevent burning about 5 to 10 minutes. And then you want to drain the rice and combine the rice with the beans and the corn and the carrot in a pressure cooker. And then you want to add 4 cups of water and a pinch of salt. And when using a pressure cooker, you want to slowly bring it up to pressure. And you're going to hear like this hissing sound. And then once it's up to pressure, you want to turn it all the way down to low, possibly even put what's known as a flame deflector underneath it, which will more evenly disperse the heat. And then let it cook for about 50 minutes. And then once this recipe is done, you can eat this dish just as is with some side accompaniments, garnished with maybe sesame seeds or scallions, or you can wait until it cools down a little bit and you can make sushi. You can roll this up in seaweed or nori seaweed and make yourself some sushi. So just a little bit of an idea of what you can do with black soybeans, which isn't going to be like the same as having like a cake of tofu. It's going to be more along the lines of eating them like you would a bean. So yeah, I hope maybe someone tries this recipe and gives maybe soy a chance if they haven't already. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about keto. Most listeners already know that this is a very bad diet. I've talked about it a couple of times before on my show, but now, like every other little label or certification that you see on food, now there's a keto certification. So if anyone's ever been, reading the label of a package in the store, you'll see there's the USDA label. There's kosher, of course, paleo, vegan, what else? AIP, autoimmune protocol. So now there is new kosher certification. So now people can get this certification from a company to, I guess, have your product be recognized as being keto certified. So I was looking into this. I'm thinking, I wonder how much this costs a company to do this. And from what I could see, that if you want to, I guess, have this little label on your package that says keto certified, and it certifies, I guess, up to 10 products, it costs almost $25,000 for 3 years to have this tiny little label on your product, even if you could already say, not that I'm obviously advocating for keto or really most of these labels, but you could just write on your package like, hey, it's keto, hey, it's vegan, hey, it's organic. But no, that's not good enough. Someone has to monetize off of this. And of course, I'm assuming it's the same people who are behind the kosher label. So now, with all these labels, you have to pay this fee. You have to hand over some shekels if you want this little stamp on your product. And it probably works the same way, where if you don't have this little thing on your product's going to be relegated to the back of the shelves and isn't going to be featured. And maybe, the big foods like, Whole Foods, which I like to call Whole Fools, will probably just drop it. So this is another way to muscle out small businesses that, maybe have a really good, wholesome product that, is actually healthy and isn't full of gross ingredients, to just basically push those people out of the way so these more toxic products can get, a front seat. So I was really surprised with just how expensive that is. I mean, could you imagine? I mean, of course, I guess these companies have a pretty decent amount of money to start out with if they're a big company, but just to pay for something that you probably already have in the header of your product anyway, you have to basically pay $25,000 for 3 years. I think that's pretty absurd. I think that's really very criminal, actually. That's like $7,000 plus a year just to put some little sticker on something. All right, I had another list. And this is basically, I just wrote from my note, I'm like, this is the new Zog label, this keto certified, and sure it is. Just another way to, like I said, make the bucks. And keto, of course, is a really gross diet. It was originally used in the 70s to treat children with epilepsy. There are way better ways to treat a child with epilepsy. Of course, some of those could be cannabis oil or CBD or other types of dietary interventions, and to put a child on a very high-fat diet. And when they first started doing this in the 70s, they were using the worst types of vegetable fats too. And I think they did see some, response, because they had probably cut out other things. But this is not good for anybody. I mean, those fats are terrible for the brain. They're terribly, denatured and refined and processed. So definitely not the way to go. And I've also seen this vegan keto, which I think I touched on before, being touted by, it seems, a lot of these healing and detox facilities, because I get a lot of emails on that type of stuff. And they're all touting this, vegetarian version of a keto diet, which wouldn't be the bacon and wouldn't be all that stuff, but it's still using, oodles of coconut oil and not really a wholesome, natural or really feasible diet for most of the world, if you think about it. Like, most of the world, even, the non-white world, they can't afford to eat like this. Think about it. Most people eat the same thing day in and day out, especially in the more, primitive, if you say, like, parts of the world. Like, this breakfast, lunch, and dinner are pretty much the same thing. No one's got any time or money for this. It's not even a thought for them. Not that we should be emulating the ways of those people in general, but I'm just saying, like, these are ridiculous things to emulate, to try to eat a diet like this. Like, it's not natural. And of course, if it's being touted by the Zog media as being a way to slim down, it's got to be bad for you. And of course, all these products, these keto products, contain all these sugar alcohols like maltol and erythritol and all of this. These are horrible for one's gut. They cause all types of gas and bloating and yeah, just really, really bad for you. And they're even marketing these keto bars now. They're calling them Good Fats Bar. I see the whole border of this website called Love Good Fats. That's the name of the brand. Totally trannied out with a tranny flag. Not surprised. Looks like this company is already paying for the gluten-free label and the non-GMO label. But look at some of these ingredients. Chocolate-flavored coating, the inulin, which is a fiber that's hard to digest. Let's see what else. Stevia, I'm not a fan of that. Gum acacia, also that's not good for the stomach. Just natural flavor, tons of fats. Like, this is just, no. And people are going to be eating these. This is no different than, it's been said before. This is the paleo or the Atkins of now, essentially. No different. So yeah, it's a little bit on that. And that's that on that. Okay, now I wanted to mention something about a first aid kit. Yeah, how to stock up or how to keep a little bit of a first aid kit or a summer wellness kit, because most people spend a little bit more time outside this time of year, which is great. Lately, the weather has been just kind of over here for me. I know a lot of other people are dealing with intense heat waves and things of that nature. But nevertheless, here's a little guide of things that you might want to carry with you, maybe in a knapsack or something like that, or in your beach bag, that can help, with any bumps, bruises, or stings, or stuff like that. So here's the article. It's called Stock Up. Keep these natural products on hand to soothe summer's scrapes, aches, and why did I eat that woes. Nurse Nature has everything you need to deal with the minor ailments that slow you down in summer. Keep these ointments, teas, tinctures, and more in your bathroom or even kitchen cabinet for those ow moments. So the first plant they mention is arnica. Topical arnica stimulates and dilates blood vessels near the surface of the skin. This improves circulation to an injured area and promotes the healing of bruises, sprains, strains, muscular inflammation, aches, and pains. Arnica can be used as a poultice or in a cream or salve. It should not be taken internally except when used in a homeopathic preparation. And it says, if you have a wound that's healing slowly, take vitamin C to help speed up the natural healing process. Vitamin C also helps the body metabolize fats and proteins and maintains healthy bones, teeth, gums, and cartilage. And that is true. And the next one is echinacea. If you feel a cold coming on, echinacea can be used as a tincture, tea, supplement to help combat infections, relieve cold symptoms, and support the respiratory system. Research shows that echinacea may even shorten the duration of a cold. And the next one is white willow. Willow is nature's pain reliever. White willow bark tincture, tea, or supplements may help relieve headaches as well as fever associated with the common cold. Its analgesic properties provide short-term relief of lower back pain when used topically as a poultice, cream, or oil. And I think this is what aspirin is made from, I believe. Yeah, it is. So this is the plant that aspirin is made from. The bark of white willow contains salicin, which is a chemical similar to aspirin, and aspirin is acetylsalicylic acid. So this is the original form of aspirin, white willow, also known as Salix alba. And for the best vitamin C supplement, if anyone was wondering what I would recommend for vitamin C, there's something that I like to take. It's rather potent. It's a little expensive, but a little goes a long way, and I think it's a good thing to keep in one's apothecary cabinet. The brand is called Shen Blossom. That's S-H-E-N Blossom, and they have this powder that comes in a nice violet glass jar. It's potent C, so the word potent, hyphen C, collagen vitamin C formula. And this is a formula that combines all different types of plants that happen to be high in vitamin C, which is really cool. And I use this sometimes. You can just have it as is, like you can just kind of put it in your mouth dry and chew on it, or you can mix it with like a little bit of water. But it's really, really good stuff. It has, ingredient-wise, like it has fermented seaweed, umeboshi plum, rosemary, Japanese gooseberry, frankincense, shishito pepper, kumquat, lemon peel, bitter tangerine, amla berry, sazandra berry, Hungarian paprika, Japanese wood sorrel, watercress, and matsuba, which is a Japanese pine needle. This is some really potent stuff. It's not like the kind of chemical vitamin C, which is really just, I think, ascorbic acid, and just going to pee all that out. Like, this is really, really good stuff. And this is also a good alternative to those animal collagens, which are really heavily processed and grow bones in people. That's one of the creepy side effects of ingestion of those things. They just kind of like grow your skeleton. I've noticed too, with a lot of these people who eat like a very meat-based diet, they tend to have a wider skeleton. And it's interesting if you note the three sub-races of like the Northern Asian, the Mongoloid type, Korean, Japanese, and Chinese, looking at their faces and bodies, think of which one eats the most amount of meat. It's Koreans, because if you look at their faces and their bodies, they have those very wide jaws. A lot of the women end up getting the double jaw surgery because the jaw is so wide. And from what I know of race and nutrition, I believe this is from overconsumption of animal proteins, which actually grow the bone. And if you look at the face of a Chinese or a Japanese person, it's not nearly as wide because they don't eat as much meat. And I've had Koreans tell me, actually, that they do eat more meat than Chinese and Japanese, which is kind of the way I was able to figure this out in the first place. Okay, so a little side note there, but back on with the article. Okay, so other things. Those are the three plants that are good: arnica, echinacea, and white willow. And now here are some spices which are handy in the summer. The first one is ginger. You've probably got ginger root in your kitchen. Well, I hope everyone's got it fresh and dried, and even a couple of even crystallized. It's nice to have ginger in a couple of different ways. Ginger has been clinically shown to prevent and relieve nausea and vomiting. A fast and effective digestive aid, ginger root tea helps with indigestion, lack of appetite, and gas. The tea can also relieve congestion from bronchitis, the common cold, and flu. And it's also great to cook with. I like to use a little microplane grater to kind of just grate in a little bit when I'm making, you know, kind of stews and things like that. And if I happen to be cooking a miso soup, I'll just add in a slice of ginger and infuse the soup with that. The second spice is turmeric, another familiar spice. Antioxidant-rich turmeric in capsule form may help cleanse and protect the liver, aid the digestive system, relieve gas. Turmeric can soothe pain and inflammation. When used orally and topically, it can treat minor cuts, burns, and skin irritations. And the third, I think I mentioned 2 weeks ago, I did a little piece on this, cayenne. Cayenne works quickly, cayenne powder, to staunch the bleeding of a wound and start the healing process immediately. In ointment or cream form, cayenne offers relief for joint, muscle, nerve, and low back pain. And it says here, if you nick yourself while working in the kitchen, apply cayenne pepper to the wound or mix with a little water and apply the paste. It stings, but it helps the blood clot. And here are some good oils for the summertime. Tea tree. Tea tree oil can be placed directly on cuts and scrapes to clean, disinfect, and reduce pain. It's useful for athlete's foot, minor burns, insect bites, and fungal nail infections. It may be used directly on skin or with a carrier oil. Tea tree oil is generally non-toxic and irritating, but it may cause skin irritation in sensitive individuals. And the second oil, another great one, oil of oregano. Oil of oregano is a supplement taken orally to deal with problems such as colds, coughs, flus, allergies, and intestinal parasites. Oregano is also available as an essential oil, which is not the same as oil of oregano and not to be taken orally. When mixed with a carrier oil, oregano essential oil can be used to treat a variety of skin conditions, including dandruff, acne, athlete's foot, and psoriasis. And here's a little thing on the sidebar. They're saying build a natural first aid kit. When on the go this summer, whether camping or traveling, it's a good idea to have a few essentials on hand. Stock your natural first aid kit with homeopathic arnica, a calendula cream, ointment, or salve, tea tree oil, ginger tea or tinctures, vitamin C lozenges, heat-stable probiotics, and remember to add some witch hazel for wound cleaning. I'd say peroxide as well is nice to have, 3% peroxide, a pair of tweezers, and some bandages. And my favorite brand of vitamin C lozenges is a brand called Zand, Z-A-N-D-D. These are made from just brown rice syrup, so they're free of refined sugars, and they have no natural flavors either. It's increasingly harder to find these days. So that's just a little bit about the summer medicine chest. I hope that helps. Okay, now I wanted to mention a little something about astrology, which I've talked about before in the past when I did that show with Thomas, that Aryan Hodgepodge show. We talked about astrology a little bit. And of course, there's many types of astrology. There's the one that we're most familiar with. There's the Celtic astrology, which is based on trees. There's Chinese astrology, which is based on animals, which goes by birth year. There's Nine Star Key, which is a Japanese astrology. But today, I just wanted to focus on, I guess, what you'd call regular astrology. And it's a really cool little article or clipping that I want to read. I've had it for probably about a decade or so. It's really interesting, though, because it tells you the general characteristics of your sign, the part of your body that's associated with the sign, the health sensitivities that you might have based on your sign, and also the supportive therapies which could work alongside your sign. I know there's something called cell salts, which I haven't personally used myself, but I've heard a lot of good things about them, and they tend to correlate with use in regards to your sign. So I'll start with Aries, which is considered the first sign of the zodiac, and they give you dates for it's when it falls in between. I think with every year, it tends to be a little bit different. But for the most part, these dates are rough. Like, for example, Aries is March 21st to April 19th. And the general characteristics of an Aries person is energetic, headstrong, in charge, enterprising, enthusiastic, restless, and fiery. The body part associated with Aries is the head and the face. The health sensitivities of an Aries can be headache, eye, nose, and ear infections, fevers, vertigo, colds, facial acne, and epilepsy. And the supportive therapies that are good for Aries is tension-reducing activities, martial arts, challenging work, performing arts, social activities, meditation, biofeedback, and massage. So the next one is Taurus. That's mine, by the way. I'm a Taurus. April 20 to May 20. The general characteristics of a Taurus person is determined, practical, beauty-loving, jealous, artistic, materialistic, and loyal. The body association for Taurus is neck, throat, and thyroid gland. health sensitivities for a Taurus person are sore throats, swollen neck glands, laryngitis, bronchitis, asthma, and when someone has a sinus infection, sinusitis. Supportive therapies, grounding activities such as gardening, walking in nature, pottery, yoga, and massage. Cool. I like pretty much most of those. The next one is Gemini. That is May 21st to June 21st. The general characteristics of a Gemini are versatile, non-conforming, communicative, flexible, inventive, and nervous. And the body association are the hands, the arms, the shoulders, the lungs, and the nervous system. The health sensitivities of a Gemini are bronchitis, asthma, neuritis, and muscular problems in the hands and shoulders. Supportive therapies for Gemini people include activities to dispel nervous energy, intellectual pursuits, writing, travel, exercise, deep breathing exercises, and yoga. Next one is Cancer, June 22 to July 22. General characteristics of a Cancer person: nurturing, sensitive, tenacious, territorial, moody, imaginative, and intuitive. Body association is chest, stomach, and breast. Health sensitivities include digestive ailments, ulcers, weight problems, breast disease, and chest infections. Supportive therapies for a Cancer are activities to eliminate worry, meditation, dancing, swimming, and sailing. The next one is Leo, July 23 to August 22. Characteristics of a Leo include lively, optimistic, generous, self-centered, charismatic, dignified, and proud. Body association for Leo is heart and spine. Health sensitivities are heartburn, fevers, back pains, high blood pressure, and heart disease. Supportive therapies for a Leo include activities to avoid burnout, performing arts, social activities, work in which they, quote, shine, meditation, and massage. And the next is Virgo, August 23 to September 22. Virgos are efficient, service-oriented, analytical, fretful, health-conscious, and judgmental. Body association for Virgos are intestines and spleen. Health sensitivities tend to be digestive ailments, diarrhea, and hernia. And supportive therapies for Aries, or Virgo rather, is earth-based activities to alleviate rigidity, walking, pottery, gardening, meditation, massage, health, and nutrition studies. The next is Libra, September 23 to October 22. And those characteristics of a Libra would be communicative, just, charming, gentle, luxury-loving, diplomatic, and shrewd. Body association is kidneys and lower back. Health sensitivities are kidney and bladder ailments and diabetes. Supportive therapies for Libra include calming activities, relationships, intellectual pursuits, travel, breathing exercises, fencing, and yoga. The next zodiac sign is Scorpio, October 23 to November 21. General characteristics of Scorpio include resourceful, secretive, willful, possessive, passionate, and intuitive. Body association is the pelvic organs. Health sensitivities include pelvic diseases, including painful menstruation, cystitis, and constipation. Supportive therapies for Scorpio include activities to alleviate worry, relationships, music, dance, meditation, and water-related activities. Next up is Sagittarius, November 22 to December 21. General characteristics of a Sagittarius include adventurous, independent, energetic, outgoing, optimistic, philosophical, and arrogant. Body association is hips, thighs, and liver. Health sensitivities include hip and leg injuries, sciatica, fevers, and liver disease. Best activities for a Sagittarius include activities to rechannel excess energy, exercise, challenging work, performing arts, social activities, travel, higher learning, and meditation. Next is Capricorn, December 22 to January 19. Capricorns are ambitious, conscientious, organized, sensible, hardworking, and melancholy. Body association is knees, bones, and teeth. Health sensitivities include arthritis, lameness, neuralgia, and dental disease. Supportive therapies include activities to counteract overwork effects, gardening, pottery, sculpture, walking, swimming, and massage. Next is Aquarius, January 20 to February 18. General characteristics include independent, original, humanitarian, loyal, determined, and stubborn. Body association of an Aquarius is ankles, calves, shins, and circulatory system. Health sensitivities include high blood pressure, varicose veins, swollen and sprained ankles, and muscle cramps. Activities for Aquarians that are supportive are calming activities, reading, writing, travel, bicycling and other open-air exercises, extra sleep, and meditation. Pisces, this is the last one. February 19 to March 20. Pisces people can be compassionate, sensitive, emotional, intuitive, secretive, and impressionable. Body association for Pisces is feet, pituitary and pineal glands, and lymphatic system. Health sensitivities are foot disorders, conjunctivitis, glandular disorders, and weight gains. And the supportive therapies that are best for Pisces include activities to alleviate sensory overload, relationships, music, dance, reflexology, water-related activities, such as swimming and sailing. I thought that was pretty cool. Just a little bit about how different zodiac signs work with different parts of the bodies. And I definitely think there's some truth to this. There's good and bad characteristics associated with all of the signs. I think the body association aspects are pretty spot on in regards to some of us having, you know, certain, you know, propensity for, health issue for a certain part of the body. And if anything, even if one doesn't believe in astrology, just say, hey, maybe this is an area of my body or my, you know, that I have to give extra care to be extra gentle with or just be extra aware for. And maybe you've got some ideas for some good supportive therapies that you would enjoy because, you know, not everyone likes the same types of physical fitness. And it's important that we all move in a certain way, but not everybody likes the same type of movement. So at the very minimum, maybe you found a new way to engage in movement. So now I want to talk a little bit about homosexuality. I found some interesting information in this older book that I have. It's called Dr. Beeler's Natural Way to Sexual Health. And this is written by a doctor whose name was Henry G. Beeler. He also wrote another book called Food is Your Best Medicine. This book came out in 1972. And at that point, homosexuality was still listed under the category of mental illness in the DSM. It wasn't removed from the DSM as a mental illness until 1987. So just briefly a little bit about Dr. Henry G. Beeler, and then I'm going to go on to read this this passage about homosexuality. So Henry G. Beeler, born in 1893, lived to 1975, was an American physician. He was best known for his book, Food is Your Best Medicine, which advocated the treatment of disease with foods. He is widely recognized as a pioneer in alternative medicine who used non-pharmaceutical, diet-based therapies to treat his patients. Beeler opposed the use of any drugs, including aspirin. He also rejected the germ theory of disease, and his ideas were rejected by medical experts as quackery. Well, of course, they would be. If you're a doctor and you do the right thing, you're a quack. If you're an anthropologist and you do the right thing, you're a racist. This is how it works in this Jew world. So the germ theory of disease is Pasteur's theory, which when Pasteur was on his deathbed, he admitted that Antoine Beauchamp, who said that the opposite is actually true. I'm trying to remember what he actually said because the Pasteur germ theory is complete zogwash. It is basically kind of the basis for the whole allopathetic medical thing, that whole system, and it's not true. Antoine Beauchamp is the man who really is the one who has the right idea with the germ theory. And I'm just trying to see what it says about him. Let's see if I can just, so I can just make this clear for everybody and for myself as well. Looks like some of his information could have been scrubbed from Google. Not too surprised about that. Oh, look, germ theory denialism and anti-vaccination myths. Ooh, they're trying to link that stuff up together, right? Makes sense. That's what would happen. Germ theory denial and anti-vaccination myths. Huh. I just want to try. See, they're making it harder and harder to find any information that's viable. Okay, so Pasteur's theory, this is Pasteur's theory of germs. It claims that fixed species of microbes from an internal source invade the body, and that's the first cause of infectious disease. This concept of specific unchanging types of bacteria causing specific diseases became officially accepted as the foundation of allopathic Western medicine and microbiology in the late 19th century. Also called monomorphism, it was adopted by the American medical industrial complex, which began to take shape near the turn of the century. This cartel became organized around the American Medical Association, AMA, formed by drug interests for the purpose of manipulating the legal system to destroy the homeopathic medical profession. And yes, that is very much true. Still not really getting to the root of what it says for Beauchamp. Let's see. Wow, they've really scrubbed a lot of his work. How disgusting. I remember typing his name into Google not that long ago, and a picture of him coming up. He's got a mustache, nice-looking mustache, and it looks like they've scrubbed so much you can't even find, like, a wiki on him. Maybe they just completely got rid of him. Wow. Looks like I can't find anything about him. That is just awful. And I am... Nope, am I spelling his name right? Maybe I was spelling it right. Ah, I think I was spelling his name incorrectly. So here's just a little side note on Antoine Beauchamp. Because this Dr. Beeler, who I want to mention, he believes in the work of Antoine Beauchamp. So Antoine Beauchamp, Pierre-Jacques Antoine Beauchamp, born 1816, died 1908, was a French scientist now known for breakthroughs in applied organic chemistry, and he had a bitter rival with Louis Pasteur. Beauchamp developed the Beauchamp reduction, an inexpensive method to produce aniline dye. He also synthesized the first arsenical drug, arsenolanic acid, which was later used as a chemotherapeutic drug. That's not such good stuff. But Beauchamp's rivalry with Pasteur was initially for priority in attributing fermentation to microorganisms, later for attributing the silkworm disease to pea brine microorganisms, and eventually over the validity of the germ theory. Beauchamp also disputed cell theory. So that's a little bit about him. So he basically doesn't believe that, I guess, diseases are caused by germs. This is what he says, claiming discovery of molecular granulations in biological fluids were actually the elementary units of life. Beauchamp named them microzymas, that is, tiny enzymes, and credited them with producing enzymes, which were the builders of cells while evolving amid favorable conditions into bacteria. Denying that bacteria could invade a healthy animal and cause disease, Beauchamp claimed instead that unfavorable host and environmental conditions destabilize the host's native microzymas, whereupon they decompose host tissue by producing pathogenic bacteria. While cell theory and germ theory gained widespread acceptance, granular theories became obscure. Beauchamp's version, microzymon theory, has been retained by small groups, especially in alternative medicine and in those competent in the use of dark field microscopy. Well, this guy is on point because everything in allopathic medicine is dollar-based, so Pasteur was really just like a marketing tool, essentially. So that's just a little side note there on the man who's behind, the real theory of germs, not the Pasteur theory. So here, back to Dr. Beeler. So Dr. Beeler did not believe that germs caused disease, but were merely a concomitant of disease, and that's in line with what Beauchamp thought. He believed that disease was caused by something called toxemia, and that it could be cured through therapeutic dieting. Beeler also stated that discarding the germ theory of disease opened the way for him to explore methods of eliminating the stagnating waste products from the body. Briefly stated, his position was improper foods cause disease, proper foods cure disease. Beeler was also an anti-vaccinationist. I guess that was the big word for what they used to use back then. Buehler was often at odds with the AMA because he believed that drugs were harmful and advised his patients to avoid them. His approach to treating his patients may have been very dangerous. I don't think that's true. Had any of them developed a serious illness requiring the use of antibiotics, but one which could be remedied through lifestyle changes, the illness would have gone untreated and would possibly have resulted in the patient's death. Well, there are, I guess, a certain, you know, small number of instances where maybe taking an antibiotic would be the best thing, but most of the time they're prescribed for a cough, which is ridiculous. And Buehler was also an outdoorsman, a musicologist, and an accomplished artist. He used diet to treat disease of a number of celebrities, and celebrities are, these are people from a while ago, so it might not be too familiar to the younger listeners, Greta Garbo, Gloria Swanson, and Gloria Stewart. Swanson suffered from stomach pains and visited Buehler for a charge of $3. He put her on a cleansing diet of a puree of zucchini, celery, and string beans. Swanson started to feel better on the diet and became a convert of his ideas, which she embraced for many years. So he wrote this book that I'm going to read from called The Natural Way to Sexual Health. Then he wrote the other book that I mentioned, Food is Your Best Medicine. And it looks now that most of his work and most of his publications and recordings of lectures have been archived by the Price-Pottinger Foundation, which then broke up into two different foundations. It broke off into another one, which is the Weston A. Price Foundation, which is now run by Sally Fallon, who is not a healthy, not a healthy person. I don't think she looks very healthy. I think she looks very inflamed. Her skin is very red and she's very large. She has that look of someone who's taken in, like a lot of like, you know, collagen, and has that very like wide look that I just mentioned earlier on this show. Not a healthy look. Actually, when I was in nutrition school about 15 years ago, she came to speak at my school. I happened to not be there that day, but I got the recording so we could listen to them at a later point. And I remember her saying that she put a whole stick, entire thing, one cup, 8 tablespoons of butter in her oatmeal in the morning. And I was just like pretty shocked, still kind of shocked with that, because I really don't know any other health person that would advocate doing that. So just, you know, not great advice. But anyway, this guy has some good stuff to say, but like many things, their information can sometimes be, acquired or procured by people who really aren't on point with health. So that's just a little bit about Dr. Buehler. And now I'm going to read this chapter from the book called Natural Way to Sexual Health. The chapter is called Homosexuality and Lesbianism. It's a rather short read, and I'm not sure I agree with everything he has to say here, but I've never heard this information mentioned anywhere, and I've been studying anything I really can get my hands on in regards to, you know, this topic of homosexuality and trans, because it's really important that everyone understands it, not just sees, you know, the fact that it's very degenerative in many ways, and it's, you know, it's harmful, but just really understands it from a health perspective. So here we go. Homosexuality and lesbianism. Homosexuality in both male and females remains an area that requires much further research. I disagree with many of the current sexual authorities who state that homosexuality is a mental or psychological problem only. I believe that the basis for an individual's turning to homosexuality may often be physical, the result of an injury to the sex center of the brain. The brain can be divided overall into three parts: a sex center, a digestive center, and a locomotor center. The sex center may be further subdivided into the head brain and the solar plexus brain. The head brain controls the eyes, ears, nose, and mouth, and the ability to become sexually aroused. The strength and power to act comes from the power of the solar plexus, the abdominal nerve center, that would be the third chakra, the action dependent upon the ability of the adrenal glands to function. The brain sex center cannot function without cooperation from the pituitary and the thyroid glands. Unfortunately, in a few cases, a pregnant mother may have taken a drug like thalidomide or some other harmful substance. Now, thalidomide, if people don't know, that was a drug that was prescribed, I believe, in the 60s and 70s for morning sickness. It ended up causing terrible birth defects for children. It was terrible. The children were born with no arms and legs. They just kind of had like little stumps. It was terrible, terribly heartbreaking. And a lot of these people are still alive to this day. because they're not even that old, I guess. So such drugs, together with large amounts of food toxins, poison nerve development centers in the unborn baby, resulting many times in irreparable nerve and brain damage. It is a scientific fact that the largest part of the anterior brain contains the sex center. Some of my conclusions concerning the sex center have resulted from my observing persons who have long sustained head injuries. I remember the case, long ago, of a man who was kicked in the head by a mule. The whole front part of his brain was kicked off, but by some miracle, the hemorrhage was stopped and the wound finally healed. There resulted no diminution in mental functions, such as the ability to think and move, but the man's sex function was altered. I have also observed that when certain operations are performed involving the anterior part of the brain, sex functions have been impaired, altered, or completely destroyed. A lesion resulting from a state of toxemia can occur almost anywhere in the brain. It is my belief, therefore, that an undetermined percentage of homosexuality is the result of destructive lesions in the sex center located in the anterior brain. When nerve and brain functions have been interfered with because of toxemia or injury, there is no chance of repair, especially when the nerves are atrophied. In many of the cases of nerve atrophy and brain damage, the conditions have occurred while the mother is still pregnant. To lessen the chance of brain and nerve injury to her child, and to contribute towards a sound mind and body, it is the mother's responsibility to not indulge in drugs and to be careful of her diet while she is pregnant. I do agree with authorities on sex matters that many cases of homosexuality are due to early, distorted, faulty mother-son and father-daughter relationships. For instance, Dr. Alexander Lowen, in the book Love and Orgasm, remarks that in the case of the male homosexual, analytic experience suggests that the combination of a seductive, close-binding mother and a rejecting father is often responsible for a homosexual son. One of my patients grew up in this particular pattern. He lacked an acceptable male image, after which to pattern his masculinity. But more significantly, he over-identified with his mother and was unconsciously sexually involved with her. Weird. The result was an exaggeration of the Oedipal situation, to a point where the mother could not resolve his incestuous, feelings for his mother. In such situations, to reduce guilt, the child often feels he must sever all sexual feelings, deaden his body, so to speak. Such a striving, of course, makes for inner conflicts and also can be the case towards homosexuality. This same patient complained on his first visit to my office of arthritic pain in his entire body and was concerned because of his impotency. Though living with another man, having a, quote, love affair, he could no longer get an erection. His partner was already threatening to find another lover. At the end of his first visit and examination, I prescribed a highly alkaline diet to cleanse his body, to restore liver and kidney function, and to relieve his arthritic condition. After a few office calls, he became sufficiently relaxed to say that his lover had left. He admitted he felt relieved, not troubled by the other man's departure. He added that at the other man's leaving, he noticed within a short time his potency had returned. I suggested that perhaps his temporary impotence might be an indication that the homosexual way of life was not for him. He agreed, and he continued to see me for checkups, and we would talk. The arthritis was cured within about a year and a half. As he began to understand how his relationship with his mother had caused his conflicts, he was freed from the past. Today, he has very fine friendships with the opposite sex, and he recently told me that someday he would like to get married. There are basically two types of homosexuals. The first can identify only with members of their own sex. There is a revulsion towards the opposite sex, for reasons usually stemming from childhood. The second are ambisexual. They usually enjoy relationships with the opposite sex until situations of stress are presented, and then they turn to ones with their own sex for a sexual release. During these periods, there is a withdrawal from even hostility towards the opposite sex. After the pressure is removed and the environment again becomes tranquil, normal sex relations sometimes are resumed with females. Homosexual affairs produce varying degrees of shame, self-reproach, and feelings of guilt. Not pride? I thought it produced feelings of pride. Many times a drive for self-destruction, such as alcoholism, has its roots in homosexuality. And now he says this. I don't know if I wholeheartedly agree with what he says. Homosexuality should be understood and not condemned. Each society or each individual in a society has the right to choose his means of sexual expression as long as he does not mentally or physically hurt another human being. I mean, I personally think this whole movement is really, you know, not good stuff. So I can't say I really agree with that last sentence right there. So that's the end of the chapter on homosexual and lesbianism in this book by Henry G. Beeler. And I would add, in regards to this this brain injury, what he just mentioned, this makes me think of when I talked about circumcision, especially or razor rape, excuse me, especially if it's done on the eighth day. That of course causes damage to the hippocampus and the amygdala. And that is a form of mild brain damage, assaulting a child's genitals like that. And we all know, or most of us, I guess, know that there is a high proclivity for Jews to be homosexual over any other race. So it's definitely possible that some of what Mr. or Dr. Beeler is saying in here is on point. And I should also mention that I know somebody who was actually in an auto accident as a youngster, and it was a rather bad auto accident. Not, you know, disfiguring or disabling, and now this person is a homosexual. So when I first read this about homosexuality and injury, you know, or brain damage, it really got me thinking. So something that's pretty interesting and I thought was worth mentioning. Now, something else on the same vein of this was some origins of the word homosexual. I know now it's very trendy to use the words gay or queer or something like that. And the word queer just means strange or bizarre, essentially. That's the original meaning of the word queer. And the original meaning of the word gay is happy. So I think those words are really being used in a way that's not very accurate. So I found this on an online etymology dictionary. And it says that the word homosexual was used for the first time, I guess, in the 1800s. So it says, in 1892, in C.G. Chaddock's translation of Krafft Ebing's Psychopathia Sexualis, from the German word homosexual or homosexuali, I guess is when the word first came out. Yeah, Greek means homos, same, and sexual, I guess we all know what that means. So that's kind of a little bit of the beginning of it. And it says here, the word homosexual is a barbarously hybrid word, and I claim no responsibility for it. It is, however, convenient and now widely used. And then it says here, this was rather interesting. It says that, I guess back in the late 1800s, before the word homosexuality was used, because I guess that was a later term, more used in like psychology and clinical terminology, the word used was inversion, which is, I thought that was rather interesting, because a lot of what we're seeing now in the world is such an inversion. You know, I mean, all the things we're seeing, like right is, you know, right up and down, right and wrong, like everything is just completely topsy-turvy in this, you know, this clown Zog world. So the original meaning of a homosexual was inverted, and it says, in the 1550s, the act of inverting. In the 1590s, the state of being inverted, from the Latin inversionum, an inversion, noun of action from the past participle stem inverti, to turn about, to turn upside down. In old psychology, homosexuality. So that was what people who were homosexuals originally were called, I guess, inverted. That was the word that was used. And another word that was used in the 18th and 19th century, before the use of the word homosexuality, was a Uranian. And that's from like the planet Uranus. So they were called Uranians. I don't know if that has anything to do with the planet Uranus sounding like someone's anus, but they were also, after they were called inverted, they were called Uranians. And that was around 1844. And it says that unnatural love was another word that was used also in the 18th and 19th centuries. That word was used not only for homosexuality, it says, but also for pederasty and for incest. So I thought it was really interesting that the word inversion was used, considering we live in such an inverted world. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about more of this whole tranny stuff, and really seems like it's being extra ramped up this month because of the whole pride thing. And I found some stories that were just really ridiculous, and they're really laying this on thick. I mean, the feeling that I got when I was reading a lot of this stuff is that this is like the new 6 million. You know, this is the new oy vey. Like everyone, you know, going to be bemoaning about this, about, you know, not equal rights, this and all, you know, all the suffering and stuff. When they're bringing this on themselves, you know. So I see a parallel with that type of behavior. So the first story I found was on the website Psychology Today, and it says that people, let's see, it's waiting for it to load. People refusing to date transgenders is dehumanizing. So if any person out there does not want to have a relationship or you know, a spouse that is, you know, a tranny, you're dehumanizing them, essentially. So I'm just going to go to read this language, this read this article, and it says reasons were still expressed using dehumanizing language. Now, of course, I don't agree with this article in the least. I'm just going through it just to highlight how deranged this all is. If you are a hetero cisgendered person who wishes to date hetero cisgendered people, then shame on you for dehumanizing transgenders and the non-binary, according to a recent article published in Psychology Today. So this article that I'm reading from is an article about the Psychology Today one. This is on a website called The Daily Wire, which looks like it's pretty pro-Trump. I see they have a couple of tabs in the top, one that says Jews and homosexuality. I also see an advert for Ben Shapiro. So obviously this is a controlled outlet, but nevertheless, they're objecting to trannies objecting to hetero people not wanting to date trannies. So it says the article explores a study written by Karen L. Blair. All right, looks like the page just completely something happened. Oh, a pop-up, of course, for health insurance. Annoying. Okay. The article explores a study written by Karen L. Blair and Rhea Ashkey Hoskins in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships, which essentially chastises people as bigots for the sin of being attracted to a man who is an actual man or a woman who is an actual woman, while also arguing that the prevailing attitude contributes to the psychological harm of transgenderism. Of course, it absolutely does not. It would be nothing short of, you know, normal and healthy that someone would want to be with a mate that was the opposite sex of them, that hadn't, you know, mutilated their body and doesn't have a dysphoria. Wouldn't most people opt to date someone or to be with someone who wasn't disabled, right? Unsurprisingly, 87.5% of those polled said they prefer the two options depending on which way they swing. And they're using the word cisgender. I don't like that word. I'm going to try to avoid using that word as much as I can. I'm going to use the word heterosexual because I know that they deliberately are using that word to make us sound like sissies or queers. So I'm going to avoid using that word. Non-binary and trans people were at the bottom and typically were only chosen by people who identified as bi, or homo. For heteros, the results were other heteros. Well, yeah, obviously. The author finds this deeply problematic and believes the attitudes need to change. If trans and non-binary people lack success to one of the most stable sources of social support, this could explain some of the existing health disparities with trans communities, they write. Looking more closely at the patterns of responses, it also became clear that individuals were least likely to express an interest dating a transgender woman, so that would be a man, even if their sexual identity would indicate interest in a woman. For example, a straight man, a lesbian woman, or queer bisexual individuals. Well, a straight man is going to want to be with a woman, not a trans woman slash man, right? And a lesbian is going to want to be with a woman, not a trans woman slash man. So this put perfect common sense for me. Indeed, nearly 20% fewer people indicate an interest in trans women slash men than would be expected based on sexual identities of the individuals within the sample. The authors also examined participants' response in a similar study by the Canadian Psychological Association's annual convention, which yielded similar results. However, the authors blame this on several factors outside of nature itself. Dehumanization and prejudice, certainly, or uncertainty or lack of knowledge and issues related to bodies and reproduction. Wouldn't these be the same crazy zogwash ideas they'd give for someone who doesn't want to date outside their race, right? Pretty much the same thing. The most common reason for being unwilling to consider dating a transgender or non-binary person was the participants felt that they lacked information and understanding of what these identities mean within the context of dating. Okay. For example, many stated that they had never been really considered the question before of what it would be like to be in a relationship with one of these people. Well, obviously, why would this be a consideration for anyone? Why would anyone consider something that's not optimal, right? I mean, personally, this makes no sense. This is all like Zog speak. The authors scold participants for saying transgenders have make-believe identities for wanting to date people with whom they could actually have biological children, characterizing their language as dehumanizing. So if you don't want to date somebody who you could have biological children with, you are dehumanizing trannies. A minority of individuals mentioned desire to date people with whom they could have biologically related children. However, often these reasons were still expressed using dehumanizing language, such as a trans man / woman was not a natural man or a real man because it was not possible to have children with him. Okay, so now the truth is dehumanizing, right? A difference of opinion is hate, and the truth is dehumanizing. The authors conclude that while they cannot mandate who people should and should not date, yeah, I'd like to see what they'd like to do with that if they had their way, right? They stress that trannies dating heteros should be seen as a sign of progress every bit as interracial dating. Aha, there it is. Just as sociologists have tracked acceptance of interracial relationships as a metric of overall societal acceptance of racial majorities, future fluctuations in the extent to which trannies and non-binary individuals are included with the intimate world of dating may help illuminate the progress or lack of thereof with respect to fully including trans people into society. They should just be dating themselves, right? You know, it's not fair to think that you can do this to your body and that someone who hasn't done this is going to be accepting of it. That's really not fair. That's like someone who's a hardcore alcoholic or a hardcore heroin user expecting to find a spouse who's an athlete. It doesn't work that way. It's never going to. So that was one article that I found that I just thought was, really just ridiculous. And now they're using this language where we're dehumanizing people. So this is just more encroaching language. So that's why I wanted to share that. And now I also saw this. This was shared by Colwyn, so thank you for that. And this is a website that sells what's called gender affirming, and that's Zog speak, of course. This website sells these flaccid penises, what they call, like, I guess, packers, for little girls to put inside of their pants if they have dysphoria and think that they are a little boy. So there's this website that actually sells these what they call gender affirming supplies, which is a fake penis, which I would say is really just kind of like a sex toy for a child, and completely inappropriate. The word sex toy and child should never be in the same sentence. Looks like they make a prosthetic penis, that one that's been razor raped and one that hasn't been razor raped. I guess they come in different sizes too, possibly different colors. This is just, it actually comes with a funnel so the person can actually pee through this prosthetic penis. Yeah. Very, very, very sad. So confusing. Like, this is the one thing I think of when I think of all this stuff. This is spiritually criminal to do this to a child, to confuse them so badly that they've lost touch of the first thing they ever were, or the first thing a person is in this world is their race. The second thing a person is their gender or their sex. That's the same thing for me. Of course, the trannies think it's different, but I mean, to take that away from someone, that's spiritually criminal. It's so wrong in so many ways, you know, it's horrible. So the person who runs this site called Trans Kids is run by someone who considers themselves a gender non-binary. It looks to me like it could be like a biological woman, and this person has a gender non-binary child as well. And here's another website that talks about it. This other website has a problem with these penises, these prosthetic penises. And then if you go to this website, transkids.com, they say that for all the, quote, hate mail that they get, that they make a donation for some trans fund to kind of, like, counteract, like, all the hate email that they get. And this is really sad, too. They make these little holders for the penis packer, and they come with, like, designs that a child would like. Like, one looks like it's got Captain America on it. One has Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So they're really trying to appeal to children. I think this is just, like I said, spiritually criminal. This is so wrong in so many ways. I mean, there's so many things that you could do for a small person that would be helpful for them, that would help to develop them and, you know, I guess let them know who they are and to find out who they truly are. And this is the exact opposite of that. It's so terrible. Oh, and I also wanted to mention with that article that I read about psychology and dating, supposedly only 3.1% of people who consider themselves to be hetero would date a tranny. And the article was written by a lesbian too. Yeah. So those were two tranny stories that I found so far this week. And I actually found something else too. There seems to be a lot of this brewing. This is about athletics. A transgender man. Well, actually, no, excuse me. Transgender woman, so a man, a biological male, is basically entering women's championships and going way over, you know, like basically beating all these women. This article was in the Daily Mail. And of course, this trans athlete is saying, I'm the one that's at a disadvantage, not them. It's me, you know, feel sorry for me. I'm the one that's at a disadvantage. Trans athlete who won the woman's 400-meter hurdle at the NCAA championship claims her body is going through so many complications that she is the weakest female at the starting line. And this person is jacked, by the way, like completely pumped up. It's a black man who I guess is identifying as a woman. And like I've talked about on my race show, I guess it was last week or the week before, blacks already have more testosterone to start out with. So a black man competing with a white woman, that is so unfair. The way I see it is that, of course, all sports should be segregated by sex, but sports should be segregated by race too. To make it really fair, you want to see who's the best white person or something, who's the best black, who's the best Asian. Do that. Divide it by race and divide it by sex. I think that's the most important way to do it. And I also think that if people who are trannies want to participate in sports, let them have their own type of Olympic, like a special Olympic or something, right? But to have them do this stuff with everybody else, it's not fair to other people. So I'm just going to go through this article. This person is referring to themselves as CC Teffler. Just back about a year or so ago, this person was actually competing as a male. So it says, a transgender athlete who competed as a man before winning the NCAA Women's National Championship last month has claimed she doesn't have an unfair advantage over female-born runners. So this person made history with a 400-meter hurdle at the Division II Outdoor Track and Field Championship. So now this has sparked a lot of controversy in regards to transgender athletes. This person completed the 400-meter course with a stunning time of 57.53 seconds. Second place, trailing four behind, was a score of 59.21. She or he also earned All-American First Team honors in the fifth place finish in the 100-meter hurdles earlier that day. However, Teffler insists being biologically male doesn't provide her with any edges over female-born opponents, believing the medical procedures she's going through as part of her gender transitioning may be a significant disadvantage. Now, I don't believe that's true. And it seems like other people don't either, which is good to hear that other athletes are speaking out about this. If anything, me competing against heterosexual or biological females, seems like they're using that word cisgender. I know I just said I wasn't going to use it, but they're using that word to not just mean someone who's hetero, but to mean someone who's biologically male or female. So I'm just going to say, If anything, me competing against a biological or authentic female is a disadvantage because my body is going through so many medical implications. Well, of course, the person's decided to engage in these medical implications, right? It's going through biochemistry changes, this person says. Being on HRT, hormone replacement therapy, your muscle is deteriorating. You lose a lot of strength because testosterone is where you get your strength and your agility. Teffler added that she needs to work twice as hard to maintain her strength as her female counterparts. I work twice as hard to keep that strength. If I slack, it's like a day, it's like slacking for 3 days to set behind. I can't drink, I can't eat unhealthy because it's going to impact me harder. Well, most people shouldn't do, or everyone shouldn't do those things, or keep drinks to a minimum and keep, you know, food healthy. Claiming that testosterone could give her an advantage was also quashed by the up-and-coming runner, as Teffler says she's taking hormone suppressors and therefore it provides no benefit. Well, you can take a hormone suppressor, but if you naturally have more of something, you're still going to have more, even if you're suppressing it. That's another advantage, disadvantage, she said. Biological women are producing more testosterone than the average trans female. That's probably not true. So it's crazy. I'm the crazy one to be the weakest female, the weakest link in the chain, and to be competing against the top ones. I should be figured as a stupid one for wanting to do this in the first place. Well, like I said, I don't think that people who are biological male should be able to compete with female athletes. I think that's just really wrong. And here they show a picture of this person who's just much wider, much taller than these other two white women, one on each side. They just kind of have a look on their face like they're just kind of staring ahead, like not wanting to really, you know, be obvious in looking towards this person's way. This person only started identifying as a woman, I guess, last year, they're saying. So this is all really new. So this person probably still has tons of testosterone. And like I said, blacks naturally have more. That's why athletics should be segregated by race and by sex. And people are not pleased with this either. Like other people who are in the same sport are not pleased. Like here's a woman. She's Australian running champ Tamsin Manu said that Teffler's title is unfair and falls into a concerning gray area. She says the female category in elite sports is currently vulnerable and not being protected enough to ensure a fair and even competition. I think that it's important that people understand it's not about gender identity, Manu said. This is an issue that is surrounding what you were born as, biologically what your sex is. There's just way too much advantage with a male competing against a female. Absolutely. However, the NCAA disagrees with the advantage. The organization's transgender handbook states, according to medical experts on the issue, I wonder who those medical experts are, the assumption that a transgender woman/man competing on a woman's team would have a competitive advantage outside the range of performance and competitive advantage or disadvantage that already exists among female athletes is not supported by evidence. And I would probably venture to say that a lot of the women who are probably in the WNBA, the women's basketball league, I would venture to say probably a lot of those women are men. Yeah. And I wanted to read some of the comments on this article too. It just clicked to some other article, though. This site is always a bit funny to load, this Daily Mail site. This is so many adverts on the side. All right. I just want to... Seems like people in the comments section were agreeing that this was completely unfair. And it is. It's very unfair. And the fact that this person is bemoaning that they're the one that's suffering, this just sounds like a Jewish script to me, you know? Let's get to those comments. Very slow page. Of course, the video looks like it's popping up too. Something I definitely don't want to see. All right, looks like the comments are loading. Just give it a second to load. Well, ever since I found this article yesterday, it looks like a lot more people have commented. So, of course, one person says, "Exactly, sweetheart," with a bunch of exclamation points. So I guess that person was agreeing. Someone else wrote, "Decidingly unfair." And then someone else wrote, "No, honey, when it comes to competition, you're not at a disadvantage. You won." All right, this page is being really annoying. Let's see. Come on. Wow, so slow. Oh, let's see if I have anything else while this is loading. I mean, there was a story, I think, at some point where that person who's a trainee, Fallon Fox, that fighter, had, like, knocked out a woman, like, just out of nowhere, you know, like, in the fight, like, and that was a big thing, too, with trainee sports. So the person said, "No, honey, when it comes to competition, you're not at a disadvantage. You won. How dare you belittle the women you competed against?" I thought that was the best comment that was on here, and I completely agree. So not only is this person, like, you know, bemoaning and, like, howling and saying, you know, poor me, they're belittling, like, the people who, like, the person won against. It's ridiculous. And someone else says, if you got XX or XY, that's where you should compete, like chromosomal speaking. Anything else is just isn't fair. Someone else wrote, completely unfair, sad reflection of the world today, stunning and brave, you are joking me. So yeah, we're probably going to see a lot more of this. It's just so unfair, you know? That's not fair. And someone also wrote, regardless of any hormonal changes, she's still twice the height of the other runners with much greater muscle mass, which would immediately put them, not her, at the advantage. Okay. Well, like I said earlier, let's segregate athletics by sex and by race to make it as fair as possible. Okay, so now I wanted to talk a little bit about vagioplasty, which is not the most appetizing of subjects, but I learned a little bit about this procedure and just how it's done the other day, and I was really shocked. And very few things shock me these days anymore, but when I found out just what they do surgically and where they harvest tissue from the body to perform this, I was really, my mouth was open. I couldn't believe it. I don't know what I really thought how it was done in the first place. I kind of knew the ins and outs of what they do to the penis for this to happen. But when I actually found out the areas of the body where they harvest this material, this tissue from to make these neovaginas, I was in a state of shock. I really was, because I was just like, it's crazy. So I'm just going to read this little article that I found, and it's called Different Types of Vagioplasty. And like I said, not very appetizing or savory material. If you happen to be having a snack or eating when you're listening to this, you might want to press pause or, you know, come back at a later time or listen to this when you're not eating, because this is really just, like I said, not for the weak stomach type of people, or just not information that I'd want to hear while I was eating. So the name of the article is Different Types of Vagioplasty, Types of Surgery to Create a Vagina. Vagioplasty is surgical procedure used to create a vagina. The surgery may be performed after a woman has a vaginectomy for vaginal cancer. So keep in mind, originally, this surgery was invented for females if they had some type of issue where they had loss of the vagina, they would then again get this surgery. But now it's being used, obviously, for trannies. It may also be used to create a vagina for women born without one because of vaginal agenesis. In addition, vagioplasty can be used to create a vagina for transgender women or men as some type of gender-affirming surgery. There's that Zog speak again. Sometimes, when a vagina is created through a vaginal plasty, it is referred to as a neo-vagina. That means a new vagina. For a woman who needs a vaginoplasty, there are several types that may be offered. The type of vaginoplasty that is most appropriate depends on the number of factors. In particular, the type of vaginoplasty may be limited by the woman's age and the indication for the vaginoplasty. The surgery appropriate for an adult transgender woman, male, would not be the same one indicated for a young girl. The main types of vaginoplasty are intestinal, peritoneal, mac and dough, buccal mucosa, and penile inversion. And I will get to what all of those are in a moment. And there's something, just a little side note, if someone was born with what's called vaginal agenesis, which I just mentioned a moment ago, This is a syndrome where a young woman is born without a vagina or a uterus, or with an underdeveloped vagina and uterus. And this is also the type of person that would possibly get a vagioplasty. This surgery or this syndrome is also known as MRKH. That's Mayer, Rotansky, Kutzer, Hauser syndrome. Have not heard of this before. It says it affects between 1 in 4,000 and 1 in 10,000 female births. Okay, so back to the main article. So the first type of vagioplasty is an intestinal or sigmoid vaginoplasty. So this is the part that really got me shocked. Intestinal vagioplasty uses a section of the sigmoid colon. Yes, you read that right, or I read that right, to create the neovagina. This is done using laparoscopic surgery. Laparoscopic surgery is often referred to as a minimally invasive or keyhole surgery because there is only one small incision through the skin. For this surgery, a small piece of colon is detached and then rotated down to become the lining of the vagina. Then the surrounding colon is stitched together to restore its function. There have been some criticisms that intestinal vaginoplasty can lead to excess mucus in the vagina and mucus with an unpleasant smell. You don't say. However, these side effects have not been consistently reported. Some people see the mucus production by the intestinal tissue as an advantage. The healthy vaginal lining is also mucus-producing and self-lubricating. The colon segment is also stretchy in a way that is more similar to the regular vaginal lining than other tissue options used to line the neovagina. So technically, if someone gets this type of vagioplasty, the intestinal or the sigmoid vaginoplasty, technically part of their digestive tract is now becoming part of their reproductive tract. So in essence, intercourse is essentially sodomy. So that's what really shocked me. So basically, if a tranny has had this type of surgery, their neovagina is basically their anus. I know, it's really wild stuff. The next one is peritoneal vaginoplasty. Peritoneal vaginoplasty is also referred to as the Luhu operation. It uses the lining of the abdominal cavity, the peritoneum, to create a vagina. Like intestinal vaginoplasty, peritoneal vaginoplasty is usually a laparoscopic procedure. Women who have this procedure do not necessarily need to use dilation to maintain their vaginal opening. That is particularly true if they are having regular sexual intercourse. There is a risk of rectovaginal fistula with this procedure and with other types of vaginoplasty. A rectovaginal fistula is when the rectum and the vagina have a hole between them. Fistulas are usually treatable with surgery. All right, so that doesn't sound nearly as shocking as the other one. This uses the abdominal cavity. But I've also thought to myself while I was reading this through the other day is that this is going to affect someone's digestive health so much if you're in there, you know, fiddling around with the abdominal cavity and the colon. It's like when people get the bariatric surgery, like the lap band stuff, people who are, you know, obese or very large, they get these surgeries, which really aren't a solution to anything because they don't really change their eating habits. They're just forced to, you know, eat a certain way. And a lot of times people gain that weight back and then they have problems. I've heard stories of people having, you know, if they eat a little bit more, they end up like having to run to the bathroom. So whenever you're fiddling with the digestive tract, bad stuff, really bad stuff, especially when you're trying to turn the digestive tract into the vagina, that sounds even worse. All right, so the next one is called McIndoe vagioplasty. The McIndoe technique, McIndoe procedure, or McIndoe vaginoplasty are quite different from the peritoneal and the intestinal vagioplasty procedures. Unlike the peritoneal and intestinal vagioplasties, the McIndoe technique does not require abdominal surgery to create the lining. Instead, McIndoe vagioplasty lines the vagina with a skin graft. That skin graft is placed on a vaginal mold and then placed into a space that has been opened to become the vagina. In peritoneal and intestinal vagioplasty, no such mold is used. The mold is used consistently for the first several months after surgery, removing it for regular cleaning in order to promote healing of the vagina into an open cavity suitable for intercourse. Unlike the peritoneum and the intestine, skin is not mucosal tissue. Therefore, it does not self-lubricate. This also increases the risk that the vaginal opening will close. Because of that, women who have the McIndoe procedure and do not have regular intercourse will need to commit to dilating their vaginas for the rest of their lives. All right, the next one is buccal mucosa vaginoplasty. Buccal mucosa is the same tissue lining of the mouth. It is quite similar to the lining of the vagina. Both tissues are hairless and create mucus. Therefore, in some ways, it is an ideal lining for a neovagina created during vaginoplasty. However, buccal vaginoplasties are not as common as other vaginoplasty procedures for several reasons. Only a relatively small area of tissue is available. People may be concerned about the side effects in the mouth and cheek. In addition, the inside of the mouth is not an area most gynecologists are used to working on. Therefore, they may have to collaborate with a facial surgeon in order to harvest the tissue properly. And the last one, I think this is really the only one I was really familiar with, is the penile inversion vaginoplasty. Penile inversion vaginoplasty is only used in transgender people, let's say transgender women. In this procedure, the skin from the outside of the penis is removed and inverted to create the lining of the vagina. The head of the penis is also reshaped to create a clitoris. Finally, the scrotal skin is used to create the labia majora and minora. The disadvantages of this procedure are similar to those when skin is used for the McIndoe vaginoplasty. Hair must be fully removed to make certain that there is no hair growing inside of the vagina. The vagina requires a lifetime of dilation for maintenance. It is also not self-lubricating. Although only transgenders can get a penile inversion vaginoplasty, that is not the only type of vaginoplasty they can get. Transgenders may be offered an intestinal vaginoplasty either as a primary surgery or if they need a surgical revision. At least one transgender who also had a peritoneal vaginoplasty, but they are not widely available for this population. And then finally, the dilation. This is what has to be done after technically a wound is created in the body. That this area has to be dilated. So you chronically have to kind of force the wound to not heal. This is so, so wrong. It's so going against nature. And if anyone has an issue with dysphoria, they got to talk about it. They can't decide to mutilate their bodies. This is not the solution. Obviously not the solution. So dilation after vaginoplasty. Depending on the technique used, women or men may or may not need to dilate their neovagina for the rest of their lives. Dilation involves inserting a silicone dilator, a rod with a curved end, I would imagine it's kind of like a dildo, into the vagina and leaving it in place for a short period of time, usually around 10 to 15 minutes. Dilation can be used to increase the depth and width of the vagina through gentle stretching. This can help women who have had difficulty with intercourse after vaginoplasty. Dilation is also necessary to maintain the vaginal opening when skin is used to line the neovagina, such as in penile inversion or McIndoe vaginoplasty. The frequency of dilation needed depends on the type of procedure and how long it has been since the surgery was completed. So that's just a little bit about the background of how this is done. I was, like I said, very taken aback by that, especially with the one that involves the colon. That was just really, really very, very astounding to me. I'm very against this, obviously, for a multitude of reasons, but I thought it would be just informative that people actually know more about this agenda and more about what people are doing to themselves. And of course, like that article mentioned, let's say someone actually does go through with this type of procedure, it might not take, right? They might have to get it done a couple of more times and risk infection. And then how much sexual satisfaction can someone possibly get once they've engaged in so much, nerve damage and mutilation of the area, right? It's so criminal. It's so wrong on so many levels. And then I found an article from Vice, probably the most degenerate outlets on the internet. And it is a man who I guess is a transgender woman. So I guess that would be a man. And I guess this person's kind of making fun of real vaginas. I just thought I would give this a bit of a read. This person says, "My neo-pussy isn't a cis vagina, and I like it that way. My vaginoplasty helped me understand that gender was a lot more complex than I initially thought, and now I find truth in my wonkily queer body." So I read this article, and it really just goes on to basically say that this person, of course, when you do these surgeries, you're never going to get it right. It's never going to be a real vagina. It's never going to be a real penis. And this, it sounds like this person has gone through with this surgery, and it's not obviously, you know, perfect, whatever they were left with after their penis was mutilated. But since they seem to be, I would say, a bit angered by this, and I feel that they have the right to be angered by this, they seem to want to pick on real women who have real vaginas and say, you know, mine's better than yours type of thing. And this is just really ridiculous. You know, really, really ridiculous. Like, here's a paragraph. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I don't want to bore or nauseate the audience, but here's just a paragraph that really sums it up. Over the past few years, I've found truth and life in my wonkily queer body. I exist in my wonderful transness. My neo-pussy isn't a cis vagina. No, to me, it is far more elegant and multifarious than any simple copy or simulation. It is a work of art, a vaginal sculpture created by the parts of a penis and balls that are useful and dynamic enough to contain a second life. The scars that run along either side of my labia are my medals of honor. They hold the proud truth that I had the courage to seek wholeness. Now, personally, I would say that this is the opposite of wholeness, right? Wholeness is wholeness. It's being whole. And if someone has mutilated their body, that's not wholeness at all. So this person obviously isn't mentally well, and then wants to, like I said, insult women, insult real women, you know, insult our bodies that are capable of life. I mean, this person came out of a woman's body who's capable of life, I'm presuming, right? So there's a lot of bitterness, it seems like, with these people, a lot of jealousy and anger. It's very unbecoming and very unwelcoming. So that's it for this article. I like I said, I don't want to bore or nauseate too much with this type of information, but there's just more of this all the time, this type of, you know, behavior and speech. It's really very unsavory. All right, let's X out that page. And now, something a little on a more uplifting note. I have had this for a while in one of my folders, and here are some wonderful tips on some certain herbs and foods that women can eat to keep their vagina in good health. So maybe some people out there, maybe some misogynists might not like this information that I'm going to share, but that's okay. Vaginal health is very important. Any men who love women would obviously want women to have, you know, healthy organs. So I'm going to read through a list of foods that are really amazing for women, especially for vaginal health. And unfortunately, I found this article from an Afrocentric vegan website where this person kind of just seems like she's very anti-white and talks about being a young black teenage girl struggling, living in rural white New England. So apart from that piece of information that I just shared, there's very good information about how many tips is here. Okay, there's 12 tips. I think I agree with most of them. So here we go. Okay, so the first tip is to drink at least 70 ounces of water per day. And as she says, if you are pregnant or lactating, drink at least a gallon. Do not drink dead or chlorinated water. Filtered water is healthier. Stop drinking anything and everything that makes your body acidic. So stop the sodas and the coffees and try to purify with water and reproductive health balancing teas. I would definitely agree with that. And here are the herbal teas that she recommends: red clover, nettles leaf, red raspberry leaf, and oat straw. And she says she doesn't do all of these at once, but prefers drinking 3 to 4 cups of nettles tea. Number three, she says hypnosis erotica. I don't know if I personally agree with that. I did go over that, I guess, a couple of weeks ago on that music show I did with Young Lean about erotic hypnosis, but this is what she's saying. I don't really know if that's something, like I said, I agree with. All right, so next on the list is slippery elm. And slippery elm, I mentioned this on a show when I talked about digestive health. Slippery elm is from the bark of a tree that can be made into a tea or a porridge. It is highly nutritious and has a plethora of medicinal uses. It is very hydrating, and after taking it for a few days, yeah, it's good for vaginal fluid. Okay. The next one is okra. Chop up okra, and you can eat it raw, she says. I don't think I've actually ever had it raw. Said also you can bake it, roast it in the oven. And it's really healthy for you. It's also good for easing labor, she says. And it makes the vagina nicely moisturized, so it helps push the baby's head through. I like to make okra in a stew, personally. When I make it, I like to make a stew with okra and sweet potatoes and serve it over that grain I mentioned a while back in one of my first shows called Fonio, which is an African grain. That's my favorite way to have okra. Another really good food for vaginal health is chia seeds. Chia seeds are high in protein, calcium, and essential fatty acids, and they're good at restoring and maintaining moisture in the body. The little seeds hold up to 10 times their own volume in water. You can get white or black chia seeds. It says soak the seeds, add about a tablespoon to 10 to 15 ounces of water. I like to do it overnight and stuff because that really helps them bloom. You have to soak them in water, otherwise, like, they're really bad. Like, I know sometimes I see these pictures and I totally cringe when people just sprinkle chia seeds on top of a salad or like a dish. Don't do that. That's really not good. You have to have them bloom. You have to have them soak overnight. That goes for men and women. So yeah, soak them overnight. You could also kind of make like a porridge if you wanted to. You could soak them in soy milk or like a nut milk, and then maybe add like a little bit of maple syrup or vanilla extract, and then you could top that with like bananas or strawberries, and you'd have yourself like a little pudding in the morning or, you know, for dessert. Then she says also getting avocado and hemp, good sources of essential fatty acids. Those foods are good for vaginal health. Another food is maca root. Maca is a Peruvian radish. It kind of has like a malty taste to it. Usually comes in a powder or a pill form. This balances hormones. It's also good for your libido. This is good for guys as well as women. It's good if you're postpartum. It's also good if you are entering menopause. And you want to get, I think, a gelatinized maca. That's like the best type to get. Exercise is good for vaginal health. Eating spicy food, rather. Having things like ginger and cayenne and turmeric increase libido. Sleep and relaxation is the last suggestion. Make sure you get 7 to 8 hours of sleep for a night. So that's a little bit of a high note. After all that stuff I read about neo-vaginas and stuff, this is a little more, you know, appetizing and health-supportive information. I always try to include a mixture of what's going on in the world that might not be, you know, the most settling information or the nicest information, but also a good mix of how we can, you know, keep ourselves healthy or restore ourselves to health. All right, so now I wanted to discuss sriracha hot sauce, which is also commonly known as rooster sauce. This is a pretty well-known condiment. A lot of restaurants offer it, pretty widely available, and it's not very healthy. There are alternatives to it, but I just wanted to go through the reasons why this wasn't a healthy sauce to use. So I'm going to read a couple of articles and then break down the ingredient list and take it from there and then give some suggestions for substitutions. The article says, sriracha is way more unhealthy than you realized. If you have an affinity for spicy foods, sriracha is probably a staple condiment in your diet. Now they show some, you know, lame memes with Game of Thrones. All right, whatever. Okay. However, this heavenly hot sauce might not be as healthy as you originally thought. It appears that rooster sauce has been betraying us the whole time by making us think it's a healthy topping, when in reality it's saying it has a lot of sugar and salt. Well, the sugar and salt, that's true, but that's not nearly the worst of it. If you flip over the red bottle, you'll take a look at the nutrition label and see a list of ingredients that include chilies, sugar, salt, and I'm assuming that's just regular, you know, iodized salt, regular white sugar, garlic, distilled vinegar, which is acetic acid, potassium sorbate, sodium bisulfate, and xanthan gum. And it also contains sulfite in the form of sodium metabisulfate. So really not good stuff. Sriracha contains 1 gram of sugar and 100 milligrams of sodium per a teaspoon. Like I said, not really the biggest problem. It's really all those nasty additives. All right. Okay, so that's the end of the first article. It's kind of lame because I'm trying to look at the text and then just a bunch of ridiculous memes of Game of Thrones and Oprah, just the lamest stuff one could imagine. So first, the first ingredient is chilies, and those aren't necessarily bad. Chilies are good. The best way to actually get a spicy fix for your food is just to add chopped chilies to your food. That's the easiest way to do it, or use some chili powder, or make your own chili powder from your own chilies that you've either bought or grown and just dehydrated and grind it up, or make your own hot sauce. That's another idea too. So the chilies are not bad. The salt is iodized salt, and that's never good. Like I said, always use sea salt. And the sugar, a lot of white sugar is actually filtered through bone char to make it that white. So that actually, I think, has microscopic, or, you know, it has, it is, it has, it was, let me see. Yeah, it's part of the refining process. What they do is the juice of the sugarcane is processed and heated to crystallize, and then it's filtered and bleached with bone char, which gives the sugar its pristine white color. So that's not healthy either. And if someone's looking to avoid, you know, bones and stuff like that, just a heads up right there. And it says over here that bone char filters are not used to process beet sugar. However, this type of sugar doesn't require the same extensive decolorization. Instead, the beet juice is removed through a diffuser and mixed with additives to make the juice crystallize. So I guess this is mainly used for cane sugar. And a sugar beet looks nothing like a regular beet. A sugar beet, I'm seeing a picture right now, looks like a turnip in color, or actually not even a turnip, because turnip's got that purple blush on it. It looks like a parsnip, maybe, or lighter than a parsnip. Like, it's white. Like, it's not, you know, like that red color. So yeah, the bone char is derived from cows for filtering and bleaching the process. To make the bone char, animal bones are heated at an incredibly high temperature and are reduced to carbon before being used in a refinery. The sugar doesn't actually contain bone char particles, but it comes in contact with them. Plus, it's completely bleached and refined, which is, I think, the worst aspect of it, because it just makes it so denatured and processed. Always best to use the natural sugars. But of course, when you see a label and all it says is sugar, you don't know what type of sugar that really means. So the next list, or next ingredient on the list, would be vinegar. And I'm not really a big fan of the way vinegar tastes in general. I rarely, if ever, use it when I cook. Occasionally, very rarely, I'll use a little bit of brown rice vinegar if I'm making like a Japanese salad dressing. And also rarely, I'll use a little bit of balsamic, but I just don't like vinegar. I use lemon or lime or citrus juice in general. So vinegar basically translates vinaigre, that means old wine, like vin meaning vino and agre meaning aged. So vinegar is an alcoholic liquid that has been allowed to ferment and sour. The basic components of vinegar, including apple cider vinegar, is diluted acetic acid, which is a toxic waste product in the body. This acid is an irritant to the stomach and causes a lot of the protective mucus in the intestinal causes a loss of the protective mucus in the intestinal tract, setting the stage for ulcers, gastritis, vitamin deficiencies, especially B12, and or infection with Helicobacter pylori, also known as H. pylori. In fact, vinegar is one of the three most common dietary causes of gastritis in the U.S. today, along with aspirin and alcohol. Vinegar interferes with digestion, and consequently, the body receives less nourishment and impurities enter the bloodstream. Vinegar also promotes changes to the stomach lining cells, which can increase the risk of stomach cancer. The consumption of vinegar is also now recognized as a factor in the development of cancer in the upper gastrointestinal tract. Acetic acid stimulates the thyroid gland to pull phosphorus from the adrenal glands to negate the effects of acetic acid in the system. Depleted phosphorus results in impaired function of the adrenal glands. The use of vinegar has been shown to be harmful to the liver and to the kidneys. And I've heard that this whole apple cider vinegar trend of people doing those shots and stuff where they drink like a pretty ample amount of it, that actually causes the liver to get pickled. So that sounds pretty disgusting, kind of the same thing that would happen from someone who's a heavy drinker. Vinegar is also an irritant to the central nervous system. Regular consumption of vinegar can cause low potassium levels and lower bone density. It's oftentimes used in the preparation of stocks and broths to pull the minerals out of bones. Studies have shown that vinegar contributes to candida growth. Fermented foods such as vinegar contain high amounts of Tyramine. Tyramine can be a contributor to high blood pressure, joint pain, urticaria, irritable bowel syndrome, and headaches. I'm just going to Google that urticaria word. I'm assuming it has something to do with maybe the urinary system. Let's see. Oh, hives, actually. Urticaria, also known as hives, is an outbreak of swollen, pale, red bumps or plaques, wheals on the body that appear suddenly. So that's what that is. So yeah, there's a lot of things with vinegar that are not positive. Citrus is always better. Citrus juice is always better to use. And vinegar is a fermented process. It's saying here that the process of producing vinegar involves fermentation. The fermentation process produces acetaldehyde, which has negative effects on the body and brain. Acetaldehyde causes a deficiency of vitamin B1, an important nutrient for brain and nerve function. Acetaldehyde also causes the membranes of the red blood cells to become stiff, making it difficult for these oxygen-carrying cells to pass through narrow capillaries. When this happens, many of the body's cells do not receive the oxygen they need. Acetaldehyde indirectly promotes the atrophy of nerve cell dendrites through its effects on tubulin. Tubulin is a protein in the body that chemically changes into long filaments that form microtubules, which transport nutrients and provide structural support for nerve cells. Acetaldehyde reduces the ability of tubulin to change into these supportive structures, causing the degeneration and the death of nerve cell dendrites. There is a connection between dendrite degeneration and Alzheimer's disease. And then it goes on to say, what about apple cider vinegar? Apple cider vinegar is still vinegar. It has all the negative health characteristics that regular vinegar has. Does apple cider vinegar help with weight loss? They're saying that, let's see. So it's not only shown to be unhealthful, but dangerous as well. It actually may encourage weight gain in the long term. Plus, it's not good for your teeth to be exposed to all this acetic acid. It's not good for the enamel of the teeth. So they're saying how to avoid vinegar. Just use lemon juice, like I said, lime juice, things like that, orange juice. And if you want to make your own pickles, you can make what's called lacto-fermented pickles, where you would just use, like, you can empty out, like, a little probiotic pill and use salt. You don't have to make vinegar pickles. There are a few brands you can buy that are salt pickles. I think Real Pickles might be one of the brands. But nevertheless, it's still a fermented food, which some people say are dead foods. My belief is that the more cooked food you eat, especially the more cooked animal food that you eat, the more you're going to need to eat stuff like this to balance everything out. And in my own experience, whenever I indulge in a hot sauce, something like that has vinegar, I feel it. Like my whole digestive tract does not feel good. It's the same kind of feeling I would get when I took oral magnesium. Like I just felt kind of wrung out and hungover and just didn't feel good. So I for the most part will avoid these. Sometimes, rarely, I will use a hot sauce that's made with apple cider vinegar and has no preservatives and no sugar. But for the most part, I avoid vinegar. Okay, so the next ingredient in the rooster sauce is potassium sorbate. And this article says potassium sorbate, beneficial preservative or harmful DNA toxin. So potassium sorbate, also known as E2O2, it's a preserve that's in a lot of foods, including yogurt, cheese, wine, dips, pickles, dried meats, soft drinks, baked goods, and ice cream. Potassium sorbate inhibits the growth of mold. It's naturally found in some berries, although for the food industry, it is mass-produced synthetically. They're saying that the berry that it comes from is from the Himalayas. Isn't that the area? Yeah, that's the area I think where some of those yogis, those Aryan yogis used to, I guess, originate or hung out. I'm going to do a show at one point talking more about Babaji and some of those Aryan roots in yoga, especially in the Himalayas. But I wonder if they were eating this wild berry for medicinal purposes. Just something I'm thinking about right here. Potassium sorbate is a mild skin and eye irritant. And also, two studies have shown that potassium sorbate has the potential to mess with our DNA. In one study, Potassium sorbate is clearly seen to be genotoxic to the human peripheral blood lymphocytes. Those are the white blood cells. In another study, potassium sorbate mixed with ascorbic acid, vitamin C, cause mutagenesis and DNA damaging activity. So I pretty much avoid everything that has this in it or any type of additives, natural flavors, etc. But yeah, just a little bit of background on potassium sorbate. The next ingredient in this rooster sauce is sodium bisulfate. This is also not very good. This is known as E222 in the food industry. It is used in the food industry. It's also used in water waste treatment, in the pulp and paper industry, and in the photographic industry, and in other industries as a bleach and dechlorinator. So right there, the fact that it's used for like all those things and it's in food, like that should make one wary. It can cause irritation to skin, eyes, and the respiratory tract. If it's inhaled, it may cause sensitization or develop an allergic reaction. So yeah, this is really bad stuff. Ingestion of sodium bisulfate may cause gastro-irritation, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. So again, another thing to stay away from. It seems that most natural products tend to not have these in here, but you always got to check. So it's always good to know this type of stuff. And the last ingredient in the rooster sauce is xanthan gum. Xanthan gum is a sugar-like compound made by mixing aged fermented sugars with a certain kind of bacteria. It is used to make medicine, they're saying too. Xanthan gum is used for lowering blood sugar and total cholesterol in people with diabetes, also used as a laxative. It's used in a lot of gluten-free products. I've seen this in a lot of gluten-free, like flour-based products. Xanthan gum is also a stabilizing and thickening agent in foods and toothpastes. It's also in some sustainable and sustained-released pills. It swells in the digestive tract. It swells in the intestine, which stimulates the digestive tract to push stool through. It might slow the absorption of sugar for the digestive tract and work like saliva to lubricate and wet the mouth in people who don't produce enough saliva. And here are some of the side effects. Of course, this is WebMD, so they're saying it's safe to take up to 15 grams. I don't believe that. It can cause some side effects such as intestinal gas and bloating. It can also cause nausea, vomiting, and appendicitis, hard stools that are difficult to expel. Fecal impaction, narrowing or blockage of the intestine, and undiagnosed stomach pain. And I will say the other day I actually ate some of that Kite Hill almond milk cream cheese, and this had a little bit of xanthan gum in it, and I felt like crap the next day. So I returned it and will not be ever eating that stuff again. Yeah. It's in so many products that are trying to be like mock products, like trying to mimic like a certain thing. They put in like all these preservatives. So yeah, that's a little bit on the rooster sauce. I would say definitely avoid that. And in general, like if you're going to use a hot sauce, try to find one that at least is free of, you know, potassium sorbate, sodium bisulfate, xanthan gum, but they're still mostly going to have vinegar in it. So the best thing to do is to either make your own with like lemon juice or your own fermented thing, if that's what you like, or just to use chopped raw chilies on your food, which is what I do most of the time. I'll just chop up a jalapeno and I'll just throw that on top of like whatever I'm eating. And I think that's the healthiest and cleanest way to get a little bit of spicy food into your diet. All right, so now for the last segment of the show. I know last week I ended the show with a bit of a racial story time. I was telling a story of how I saw some unsavory mestizos acting really poorly and, you know, singing a song about sex. And I mentioned that they were talking about licking people's butts. So after I made that comment, it seemed like that brought out a lot of degenerates, unfortunately. I got a comment on the show about that behavior, and I was clear when I told the person who was going by the name Happy Merchant, I believe, that that was an unhealthy behavior, can cause hepatitis A, cancer, herpes, a host of different things. So, and then after that, it seemed like there was another degenerative commenter who made a comment that he was banned from, I guess, the Gardasil article. The person was going by the name X Doctor, and he was making these really insane claims that that people's butts should like smell good, and that you should put your finger up there and smell it. It should have an intoxicating aroma. This is actually the words he used: intoxicating aroma like a fine wine or cheese. The smell should instantly relax you and soothe your spirit. Just really just out there type of stuff. You know, just, I guess, say it's butthole husbara, essentially, you know, Pride Month type of stuff. There are many ways that humans can exchange healthy bacteria with one another, but this is not one of the ways to do it. This is, I would say, a type of activity that's a prelude to sodomy. And then it got me thinking that there's got to be a link between sodomy and raw meat. And then I was thinking that perhaps the consumption of raw meat gave humans the parasites that compelled them to engage in analingus, which led to sodomy. So that's a thought that I just had that I figured I would share. And also a couple of other details about the creator of the primal diet. His name is Ogenis Vonderplanets. I did an article on him, I guess it was back in September. If you just search raw meat in the Renegade tab, you'll probably find it. A lot of discussion in the comment section. But this guy, Ogenis Vonderplanets, he had some really strange beliefs in regarding to feces, which are really crazy. Like one of the beliefs he had was that if someone was dying of cancer, that they take a raw steak and they wipe with it and then they eat it. Just the craziest type of stuff you could possibly imagine. He also said that Aboriginal people were the healthiest because they oftentimes had fecal bacteria trickling down their leg. Keep in mind, this is a race of people that have an IQ about 68, and cannibalism and incest tend to be pretty everyday occurrences or pretty normal stuff in those communities. This type of behavior, which he's advocating, is basically what's known as corporophagia. That's like the eating of feces. This is really sick stuff, but I wouldn't be surprised if, like I said, there was a link between sodomy and raw meat. And of course, this guy was anti-water too, very much against water, said all you need to have. So I just got cut off before I was saying that this guy, Ogenis Vonderplanets, was very anti-water. He was more into juices and milks besides mineral water, and said that dehydration was actually delipidation, which is not from enough animal fats. That was his belief. He also suggested that people use their canine tooth to bite into a raw egg that was covered in feces. And sometimes when you're keeping chickens in the beginning, when you're just kind of getting the hang of it, a chicken egg will be covered with feces, which is not really optimal. But he was suggesting that you bite into an egg that was covered with poop. So this is really, really very disgusting stuff, but still nevertheless stuff that I think people should be aware of. I'm not going over this information to be disgusting. I'm going over it because I want to make people aware of the things in this world that are perhaps disgusting, but nevertheless, awareness is power. So that's it for this week. I hope everybody enjoyed the topics at hand, and I will see you next week. Good night.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail right around all the seven oceans, drop it straight into the deep blue sea. She's as sweet as Tupelo honey. She's an angel of the first degree. She's as sweet. She's as sweet as Tupelo honey. Just like honey, baby, from the bee. You can't stop us on the road to freedom. You can't keep us, cause our eyes can see. Men within sight, men in granite. just like money, baby, from the beach.
You can't stop us.